True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
In the early morning of April 22, 2016, relatives of the Roden family in Pike County, Ohio, began to discover family members brutally killed in their own homes. In all, 8 members of the Roden family were murdered, including one minor, 16-year-old Christopher Roden Jr. All of the victims had been shot to death. 3 young children, including a newborn infant, were left alive. Investigators determined early on that the killings were planned and carried out by at least 2 perpetrators who knew the family well. But it took over 2 years to make any arrests. This crime scene investigation is the most extensive in the history of the state of Ohio. Evidence of cockfighting and marijuana growth operations were found at some of the crime scenes. But the motive may have been something as simple as a child custody dispute. Join us at the quiet end for the Piketon Massacre. Due to the methodical nature of these killings and the lack of forensic evidence at the scenes, these murders have been described as a premeditated and sophisticated operation. 4 people have been arrested, and the death penalty is on the table. So this is a fascinating case that was recommended to us by Christy W. So thank you, Christy.
It is fascinating. A lot of people involved in this case. So I'll try to remember who I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, there's usually only 2 last names you're dealing with.
Fortunately.
Yeah.
So the beer for this is called Psychopathy. And it was one that was gifted to us by 2 great listeners from Ohio, Caitlin and Sarah. Psychopathy is an IPA brewed by Mad Tree Brewing in Cincinnati. Nice hazy orange color, white head, some lacing, pretty beer. Mostly a pine aroma, little whiff of citrus. Mostly a pine taste, some grapefruit, and even some grapefruit rind. You know, you get that kind of bitterness. And this is a medium-bodied beer. Easy to drink, enjoyable to drink.
All right, let's open it up. Okay, Dickie, so I want to invite you to the quiet end, but as most people know, we're quarantined at home for the past several months, so we haven't been recording at the quiet end of the bar. But we do have a quiet end here in our little home recording studio. But the problem is, the only ones to talk to at the quiet end are the dogs and a Keith Morrison poster on my wall.
A little tough to have conversations with any of those folks.
It is, but at this point I'll talk to most anyone or anything. And should I be worried that the dogs have been answering me lately?
That's when you worry. I mean, it's okay, or it's one thing when you're talking to them, but if they start talking back with you, and you're understanding what they say and agree with what they say, I don't know, Jill.
Well, that's why I think it must just be all in my head, because they always agree.
Well, that's good.
Yes. Okay, so we've opened our beer. Here you are sitting next to me. We've got the fire going in the corner. So how about you start this out? This is quite the story. Could be a long one, yeah.
So Piketon is a small town that's located about 80 miles outside of Cincinnati, and it has a population of just over 2,000 residents. Most of the residents live on farms or on country roads, and they enjoy outdoor recreation and just generally looking out for their neighbors. So you might imagine how shocking the murder of 8 members of one family in 2016 frightened the people of Piketon. So over the past 60 years or so, factory jobs in the Piketon area faded away. Some families moved on to find better lives, but the Roden family dug in their roots. They'd lived in Piketon for 3 generations. They were family-oriented and protective of one another. They were very close, and they lived within a few miles of each other. Chris Roden Sr. grew up in Piketon after his parents moved there from Kentucky. That was just over 50 years ago. After Chris Sr.'s father died back in 2008, he and his 8 siblings each inherited an equal share of the family's property.
Yes, and Chris was one of the ones that stuck around. 8 members of his family were killed, shot execution style, in one night at 4 different locations. The victims ranged in age from 16 to 44, and the only witnesses were the 3 young children left alive at the crime scenes, all too young to identify any of the suspects.
Yeah, the oldest one was only like 2 or so?
3, I think.
You're not going to get a good description of anything.
No. So the Roden family was quite well known in this tight-knit community, and for the most part, pretty well liked. Dana Lynn Roden met Christopher Roden Sr. when they were young, and they quickly became high school sweethearts. They got married in 1994. Family and friends remember Chris as a hard-working family man who was kind to everyone. He was an excellent carpenter and worked doing construction at Big Bear Lake Resort in the nearby town of Lucasville. He also went to car auctions, bought up some used vehicles. He was able to fix them up and sell them for a profit. And that could be quite lucrative. You might be surprised how lucrative that could be.
Oh, I wouldn't be. I know you can make a good amount of money.
Yeah, if you can turn it over quickly.
Yeah.
Make a couple thousand each time.
It also obviously has to be a car that people want.
Yes. He seemed to be good at picking them.
Yeah. So if I took out a 1968 Dodge Dart, nobody's going to buy that.
Oh, I don't know.
But put in a Challenger, Charger, Mustang.
Yeah, one of those muscle cars.
You got it.
Yeah. So Chris Sr.'s wife, Dana, worked full-time as a nursing assistant in an assisted living facility. She was remembered as a mom who looked after everyone else's children as well as her own. Her friends have described her as a social and really fun-loving woman. Dana and Chris Sr. had 3 children. Clarence Roden, who went by Frankie, Hannah Mae Roden, and Christopher Roden Jr. So after years of marriage, Chris and Dana's marriage actually fell apart, and they got a divorce, but they did remain friendly. Chris moved down the road and lived with his brother Gary. In fact, Chris purchased a house for Dana that was located on the same property as his, on Union Hill Road, and they continued to co-parent and co-grandparent. Seemed to get along just fine.
It sounds like they did. Didn't have any major disagreements or anything. Now, their oldest child was 20-year-old Frankie, and he lived nearby with his fiancée, Hannah Hazel Gilley, and their son. Frankie and Hannah Hazel were hoping to get married soon, and they had long-term plans to have a large family of their own. Like his father, Frankie was a hard-working man. He really enjoyed the outdoors, particularly hunting and fishing, but his passion was the demolition derby. He and his little brother, Chris Jr., loved to work on cars, and they liked to drive in the derby at the local fair.
Yeah, Hannah Hazel had recently graduated from high school, and her plan was to start college and study business. She loved children and had plans to open her own daycare after she got a business degree. Frankie also had a son from a previous relationship, 3-year-old Brentley, and he and Hannah Hazel had a 6-month-old son named Ruger, Ruger Lee Roden. Chris Jr., known as Little Chris, was known to be the wild one, and he was the baby of the family. He was fiercely independent, and he got his driver's license as soon as he possibly could. And as the first kid in his group of friends to get his license, he was very generous and eager to give them rides. So that was nice. A lot of the kids benefited from that, because this is the country. School's not necessarily close to where you live.
No, it isn't.
So Dana and Chris Sr.'s middle child, another Hannah, Hannah Mae Roden, was only 19 years old when she was murdered. She had given birth to a daughter just 4 days before the murders.
Wow.
Yeah, a newborn.
So back in the summer of 2010, Hannah Roden celebrated her 13th birthday. She'd begun dating an older boy. That was 17-year-old Jake Wagner. And Jake was crazy about Hannah. And their relationship moved quickly. When Hannah was just 16, she and Jake made plans to start a family right away. Her parents weren't thrilled at first, but they did love Jake. And as they thought about it, Dana and Chris Sr. had married when they were very young. Now, I know you're going to say about their divorce, but the marriage had lasted over 20 years.
Right, so it was pretty successful. And they were friendly as well.
Yeah, so even post-divorce, they remained on pretty decent terms.
Yes, and they were together through the raising of their children and everything, so I would say it was successful overall, considering how early they married, but that seems to be a pretty common thing among the people in this story, maybe in the region, is marrying young and having babies young.
Well, it sure is this crew.
Yeah. So in 2013, while Hannah was still a high school student, she gave birth to her and Jake Wagner's daughter, Sophia. And although this couldn't have been easy, Hannah was a very attentive and happy mom. She even brought her daughter Sophia to the high school once in a while to show her off because she was still a high school student. Hannah stayed in school while Jake worked as a truck driver with his brother George Wagner. Jake was an attentive parent as well. He provided for Hannah and Sophia, spent quite a bit of time caring for Sophia, and was very protective of them both. But, along with that protectiveness, he may have been too controlling with his wife. And there would also be rumors and suspicions of domestic abuse in the relationship. So when they were a couple, they split their time between the two sets of grandparents. Angela Wagner, Jake's mom, was excited when Sophia was born, and she went out of her way to help with babysitting and finances. In 2015, Hannah and Jake set a wedding date and had their rings tattooed on their fingers. So I know I'm older, but that's an unusual thing for me. Tattooing your rings.
Yeah, but we've seen people with that.
We have. I guess I always just thought people did that after they were together for a while and just got tired of wearing rings. But to do it from the beginning, that shows major commitment.
It does.
You can't
yes.
just take it off.
Well, you can amputate a finger, but...
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to do that.
That's drastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess some of it, like you said, I'm getting old, you know?
Yeah. So Hannah was really close to Jake's family, especially Jake's mom, Angela. And Angela would later say that Hannah was really like a daughter to her. So if we go back to the summer of 2014, Hannah and Jake's daughter, Sophia, was about 8 months old when the Wagners began doing some strange things. They hacked into the Roden family computers, phones, and social media accounts. They also set up surveillance cameras to watch the family's comings and goings. It was really as if they were trying to get familiar with the family members' routines, as well as their homes and their property.
So, a couple questions, I guess, about
sure.
this.
Mm-hmm.
What drove them to do this? Do we know?
The murder?
No, the surveillance and stuff.
We don't know. I think, personally, they were planning for the murder. But we'll get into that. I really can't see any other reason other than maybe being a controlling boyfriend.
Yeah, it's just so weird.
It's very weird.
I mean, these are two large families that, for the most part, got along pretty well together.
Yeah, they had a lot of interactions.
Yeah.
They had a granddaughter in common.
But, I mean, doing this stuff, this is just as weird.
Yeah, it was quite a surprise to everybody when they heard about it.
The other part of that would be if the Rodens found out about this, right? Or did they not ever find out about it?
We don't know. We don't know.
Okay. So much for that question.
Well, we'll talk about the possibilities as we go through this, but we really don't know for sure either way because we haven't had any trials yet. This is not resolved.
And the trials are still on the horizon. Who knows when they're going to start?
Right. Everything's kind of delayed. But Kenneth Roden's daughter, Kendra, told one reporter that there were cameras set up around Chris Sr.'s home by the Wagners in 2014. Now remember, they weren't killed until 2016.
Right. But this is a Roden who knew about cameras. Again, I guess I could find that out after the fact.
Yes.
Okay.
But back in 2014, when these cameras were put up, Hannah and Jake were still a couple. They were planning to get married and still, apparently, very much in love. So why would the family be watching the Rodens and, you know, even planning to murder the family members back in 2014? We don't know. It's very odd.
Yes.
So according to Jake, who submitted a signed affidavit in 2016, he and Hannah had broken up in April of 2015. So that's pretty much exactly a year before the murders. He claimed that Hannah broke up with him because she thought he was working too much. So he had really wanted Hannah to just be a full-time stay-at-home mom and have his babies. But Hannah wasn't ready to do that. She's so young. And according to anonymous sources close to the couple, Jake was not at all okay when she broke up with him. He was very upset, very angry about this. And he worked really hard to try and get back together with Hannah. He did everything he could to convince her to get back together, but she wasn't having it. And there are things that point to the Wagners becoming obsessed with getting sole custody of Sophia after Hannah and Jake had broken up.
So they weren't content with half custody.
Well, I don't know if it was half. I think it was more like weekends and things like that. But they weren't happy with it.
They wanted more.
If they couldn't control Hannah, they definitely wanted to control Sophia and her life. So back in July of 2015, Hannah posted lyrics from a song about domestic abuse on her Facebook page. So here's an indication that maybe Jake was abusive with her. The lyrics were, "He slowly isolates her from all of her friends. She works really hard, but he takes all of it." And after that quote, she wrote, "End domestic violence, live a happier life." So the timeline seems to imply issues with Jake, right?
That it does.
But there's no proof that Hannah was referring to her relationship with Jake, so it wouldn't be evidence of anything.
No, it couldn't be. Now, just to backtrack a tiny bit, in May of 2015, after Hannah and Jake split up, Hannah dated her brother Frankie's best friend, Charlie Gilley. Charlie also happens to be Frankie's fiancé, Hannah Gilley's brother. See, I told you it was complicated for my poor old brain.
Yeah.
But I think I got it.
Yeah.
Now, in the beginning, this relationship seemed pretty ideal. Charlie was very well liked by the Roden family, and he was just so excited to be with Hannah. He often posted photos of him and Hannah on Facebook and proclaimed his love for her.
Yeah, so I would imagine that Jake did not like this.
I'm sure he didn't.
This was like throwing it in his face almost.
Although, by the middle of summer, July or so, Hannah and Charlie broke up. So it was a fleeting relationship.
It was, but she didn't go back to Jake either.
No, she moved on.
So according to Jake, though, he and Hannah had continued a physical relationship all through that summer. But later that summer, Hannah dated another young man named Corey Holdren. And according to those who knew Jake well, this just crushed him. He was very much in love with Hannah. And once she broke up with Charlie, he thought, well, it's going to be us, right? But then she found another guy. So he was really upset to hear that Hannah was dating someone new. And he just couldn't seem to understand or get it through his head why she wouldn't take him back. He promised her everything, even crying and begging for her to take him back, but she had decided she was done. So after the tears and after finally accepting that Hannah wasn't going to change her mind, we believe that Jake went from being sad to being angry.
Well, and I'm just wondering, you know, if there's more to the idea of some domestic violence. There's absolutely no way she's going back with him. It seems to me something more is going on.
It does, and a lot of people feel that way. It's just not definite.
No, I know.
Yeah. So another thing, which was quite a shock, was that August, Hannah learned that she was pregnant again. She wasn't sure if the father was Jake, Charlie, or Corey. But when Jake learned about the pregnancy, he got excited. He was really hopeful. He offered financial help to Hannah and promised to raise the child as his own, no matter who the bio dad turned out to be. So he and his mom actually went out and bought a crib and other baby items for this new baby. But Hannah said she still didn't want to be with Jake. So he was very upset about that again. He just seemed certain that this was his baby, even though it would turn out that that baby was not Jake's. So according to the indictments, the Wagners began plotting these murders months before, if not years before. Investigators believe the planning began at least on January 1st of 2016, and that means at least 4 months of planning.
At least 4 months.
At least.
Now, by that fall and winter, the once civil co-parenting relationship between Hannah and Jake was deteriorating. Hannah was limiting Jake and his parents' visits with their two-year-old daughter, Sophia, and a custody battle began. In fact, in early April of 2016, just a few weeks before the murders, Jake and his father tried to convince Hannah to sign custody papers. Now, what Hannah didn't know was that these were forged papers. Angela Wagner's mother, Rita Jo Newcomb, was a notary, but she didn't sign the papers. She told the grand jury that she did, but she lied at the request of her daughter Angela, that's Jake's mom,
But right. So this was Jake's grandma, Rita right. Jo Newcomb.
But despite all this going around, Hannah refused to sign the papers anyway. So all for naught.
Yes. So afterwards, Jake told Hannah and some other family members that he was going to kill her. So that's significant.
Yeah, I would take that as a threat.
Yeah, you know, people say, oh, people just say that all the time when they're angry. But I have to say, even when I'm really angry, I rarely threaten to kill anyone. I threaten to kill people on TV when I'm watching politics, but I never say I'm going to kill you to anyone, and I don't think I ever have. So when anyone says I'm going to kill you, I would, you know, at least take it fairly seriously.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So according to court records, this forged document appointed a guardian for Sophia in the event of Jake and Hannah's deaths, which is strange because this is, a 19 and 22, 23-year-old kid. So they really shouldn't be planning so much for their deaths.
No.
When police searched the Wagner home after the murders, this document was found. And it was in a box belonging to Jake's mom, Angela Wagner. And the box was labeled important stuff.
That narrows it down.
Yes. So the document had been forged on April 3rd, 3 weeks before the murders. And this is going to be some strong evidence for prosecutors, I think.
In mid-April of 2016, Chris Sr. and Billy Wagner had some kind of an argument, and they had a falling out over this argument. We don't know what the disagreement was about, but there was definitely some tension between the two families.
Yeah, now here is where we were talking about, did the rodents find out about the cameras and the surveillance?
Yeah.
And I have to wonder if that's what this argument was about. But apparently Chris Sr. and Billy Wagner, who's Jake's dad, had done some business things together. I'm not sure what. It had something to do with the cars, possibly. But they had this disagreement, which became pretty much a falling out. And you have to wonder what caused that.
Yes, you are right on.
On April 17th, 2016, Hannah gave birth to her second daughter and named her Kylie. So she didn't list a dad on the birth certificate. Remember, there are three possibilities. The custody battle over Sophia was continuing as well. And Hannah Mae was now a mother to two daughters. She had two-year-old Sophia, and she had newborn Kylie. They were living with Hannah's mother, and they shared custody of Sophia with Jake Wagner. 16-year-old Chris Jr., the little brother, lived in the same house, and he was a freshman at the local high school. So I'm not sure why he was a freshman at 16. Maybe he'd been held back a year or started late. Not sure. But he was just quite a character, I guess. A real fun-loving kid.
Well, he was the wild one.
He was the wild one. And these people were a lot into outdoors things and the demolition derby.
Right.
So it's a whole different lifestyle.
I would think that school wasn't high on his list.
Well, I don't think he was planning for college, if that's what you mean.
Yeah.
Probably not. I mean, he had a lot of things to do, and I'm sure he had a pretty good idea of what he was going to do as an adult, because he'd started out young working on cars and things like that.
Yeah.
So as Hannah was celebrating the birth of her second daughter, Kylie, it really seems that the Wagner family was busily planning the murders of 8 Roden family members. The Wagners already owned several guns, of course, not unusual when you live out on a farm, but they began making their own silencers. So it's likely that those silencers were used on the night of the murders.
Yeah. One of our letters I got this past week or so said that silencer is a misnomer.
Yeah.
It's a suppressor.
Sure.
I would just point that out.
Well, yes, it doesn't make them silent. It muffles the sound.
Right.
But I think the common word for it has been silencer.
Well, everyone, yeah.
Right. So even though the term isn't entirely accurate, we get the gist.
We do.
And we always appreciate a little education, so that's cool too.
Now, according to the indictment, there were items purchased at Walmart by the Wagners that were used in the murders. Jake's brother, George Wagner III, made several purchases in the months leading up to the murders. Now, these purchases included a pair of shoes, material to make brass catchers, ammunition, a magazine clip, a bug detector.
Not insects now. We're talking about recording devices detector.
That kind of bug. And parts used to make silencers for their guns.
Or suppressors.
Or suppressors. Brass catchers are bags that hook onto the side of guns, and they catch spent cartridges. So with this type of gun, each time the trigger is pulled, a cartridge is ejected from the gun, and a brass catcher would collect them. So you wouldn't find any evidence being left behind.
Right. You wouldn't have any cartridges or casings, whichever you want to call those. So the indictment mentions that a particular pair of shoes were purchased from a Walmart. And the theory here is that the Wagners were attempting to frame James Manley for the murders. So James was a significant person of interest because after his sister Bobby Jo found two dead bodies in Chris Sr.'s home, she had called her and Dana's brother, James Manley. And James had then rushed over and discovered the dead bodies of Hannah and Dana Roden in the trailer down the road. James' shoe prints were allegedly found at this crime scene. But just one day before the murders, the Wagner family drove over 2 hours to a specific Walmart, so not the local one, to buy a particular brand and size of shoes. And these would match the type of shoes known to be worn by James Manley. So this is such a complex plot, isn't it?
I'm telling you.
If it wasn't so evil and awful, it would almost be impressive. But the police were able to get possession of the Walmart surveillance footage, which shows them buying those shoes. James lived the nearest to Dana, and it was predictable that he would have been one of the first people to come upon the victims that morning. So also, when you think about the way that the police initially reacted to James, the Wagners actually came pretty close to successfully framing James for the murders, if they in fact did these murders. Remember, they are assumed innocent until proven guilty.
I am.
Okay.
Now, Dana Roden's sister, named Bobby Jo Manley, had been asked by Chris Sr. to feed his pets on the morning of April 22nd. Hannah had a newborn to care for, and Chris Sr. knew that Dana would be busy taking care of her and their granddaughter. So Bobby Jo agreed, and she drove over to Chris Sr.'s house just after 7:45 a.m. that morning. When she walked into the house, she saw this bloody mess. The interior was covered with blood, and she saw two blood-soaked bodies that turned out to be Chris Roden Sr. and Chris's cousin Gary Roden.
Yeah, so Bobby Jo called 911, and this was recorded to have come in at 7:51 a.m. She's badly shaken, of course, and she described the crime scene, saying that the two men inside of the home looked like they had been badly beaten and they were dead. Bobby Jo gave the dispatcher the address, and they told her to walk outside of the house and stay there.
So before the first responders arrived, Bobby Jo went to a second home next door on the property where Frankie Roden and his fiancée, Hannah Hazel Gilley, had been living. Frankie's 3-year-old son, Brentley, answered the door. He's covered with blood and discombobulated, I guess is a good enough word. Brentley told Bobby Jo that his father was playing zombie. The family was fans of The Walking Dead, so Brentley would be likely to interpret things that way.
Well, I guess he sees all that blood, but who lets their 3-year-old watch that show? I think it would be really scary for him, but that's not the point of the story.
No, Bobby Jo found Frankie Roden and his fiancée, Hannah Hazel, shot to death. Frankie had been shot 3 times in the head, and Hannah was shot 5 times altogether. And they were both in bed with their 6-month-old child, who was unharmed.
But laying there with his 2 dead parents, it's a horrific thing to imagine.
Sure is.
So now there were 2 murder scenes and 4 victims. So Bobby Jo called her and Dana's brother, that's James Manley. James went to Dana's home to check on her. Once there, he found Dana and her 19-year-old daughter, Hannah, shot to death in her trailer. And this was just about a mile down the road. They had been shot execution style. Dana was shot 3 times in the right side of her head and once beneath her chin. Hannah was shot 2 times in her head, lying right beside her newborn daughter, Kylie. Fortunately, Kylie was not harmed. Thankfully, and kind of suspiciously, though, Hannah's 3-year-old, Sophia, was staying with her father, Jake Wagner, that night. Now, I guess that was a day earlier than he usually took the child for the weekends, so we don't know if it was his idea to pick her up earlier, or maybe Hannah just wanted him to because she had a newborn to deal with. We don't know.
Yeah, it could be that he was just trying to be a nice guy.
If he's innocent.
Okay.
Because if not, he took his daughter so she wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as the news of the first death spread, people in Piketon began to worry about little Chris Roden Jr., because he hadn't shown up at school that morning. So, of course, everyone feared that he had been a victim as well. Law enforcement went searching for Chris Jr., and he was found hours later in the same mobile home where his mother and sister had been killed, Dana and Hannah. So Chris Jr. had also died from gunshot wounds to his head. So this is just something that would be hard to believe if you lived in that community.
Oh, this is this little rural farming community of 2,000 people. And you have 8 murders?
Yes, but we're going to find out there were some other suspicious murders, not to this extent, not 8 people. But there were some other ones that were a little bit strange.
Later that afternoon, Donald Stone found his cousin Kenneth Roden shot to death in his camper, which was a few miles away. So this was about 7 hours after Bobby Joe first called 911. Donald had heard the news about the murders of the Roden family, and he decided to check on his cousin, who was 44-year-old Kenneth. Kenneth was Chris Sr.'s older brother. When he got to the house, Donald found Kenneth dead with a gunshot wound in his face. His body was covered with dollar bills that looked like they had been thrown over him. But was this just an attempt to make the murder look like a drug hit?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure what the denominations of the money were, but I'm just wondering why would you throw money on someone?
Certainly, the only one that had money thrown on him.
Yeah, and if it was a robbery, you wouldn't do that. So I personally do wonder if this was just a way to make this murder look like it was a drug hit. Because
yes.
That just seems like something you'd see in a drug movie.
Yeah.
Or a Breaking Bad episode.
Something you'd see or dream up of how it would represent the action of a gang member.
Yes, exactly.
Know, without any basis of reality.
Yeah, I have no reality to base that on. You're right. Dick, why are you smashing your headphones to bits?
I am just so frustrated listening to ads. Why can't I listen to my favorite podcasts without those annoying ads?
Well, I can't help you with other podcasts. However, True Crime Brewery now comes commercial-free for our Tie Grabber members.
Huh?
That's right. If you subscribe at any level, you get to listen to all of our new episodes commercial-free. And this is in addition to our bonus episodes each month. Plus, you get some great TCB swag mailed to you when you join.
At least I can listen to True Crime Brewery ad-free. I really wish other podcasts would do that. And Jill?
Yeah?
Do you know where the glue is? I just pounded up my last pair of headphones.
So the evidence showed, though, that most of the victims had likely been asleep when they were shot to death. But Chris Roden Sr. was probably awake when the perpetrators began their attack, because he was shot in the forearm, which was likely a defense wound. And he was shot a total of 9 times, more than anyone else. Plus, he had a lot of bruising, as if maybe he'd been in a fight. His cousin Gary was shot twice in the head and once in his face. And one of the shots left a muzzle stain or a gunpowder mark, because the gun was pretty much touching his temple, super close to it at least, which is like an execution-style killing. Also, wood fragments found on Chris Sr.'s body indicated that his body had been dragged across the floor, and police believe he was awake and confronted by his killer. The multiple shots and the close range of the shots really indicated a certain degree of rage, and the police believed familiarity with the victims.
Now, the investigation into the murders included speculation that they could be connected to the demolition derby, maybe marijuana growing and selling, or even cockfighting. I guess all possibilities are on the table.
Yes, yes.
In late April 2016, the Attorney General of Ohio, Mike DeWine, gave an update on the investigation at a press conference. He confirmed that they had found marijuana plants in 3 different locations, enough to suggest a grow operation. 200 plants were found in the three homes on Union Hill Road, and the value of these plants was at least $400,000. Investigators also found equipment and chickens pointing to involvement in cockfighting.
So that makes them a little less likable. But, you know, the lifestyles of the rodents didn't reflect that they were big drug growers or sellers. They lived in these modest mobile homes and drove average vehicles. It is true that the state of Ohio was going to legalize marijuana for medical use after the legislation was passed in 2016. So it's also possible that the rodents were growing the plants in preparation to sell them for medical use after the law was changed. But, you know, after that was announced in a press conference, the empathy for the rodent family fell off in the community. Now they thought, well, these people were drug dealers. They had it coming. In fact, donations to help the family bury these 8 family members stopped coming in. Even there was one business who had made a donation or a promise of a donation who canceled it once he found out there were drugs. But, you know, the killings looked like they could have been a cartel hit. The MO matched what would be expected if cartel members came up from Mexico, killed 8 people, and then disappeared before the bodies were found. And for years, marijuana was grown in Mexico and transported for selling in the U.S. But with marijuana legalization increasing in the U.S., it's become easier to grow and process marijuana inside the country and just sell it right inside. It eliminated the risk of crossing the border with the drug. There were rumors that it was the Sinaloa cartel that was responsible because they did have connections in Ohio. The DEA had documented the Sinaloa cartel's ties to Ohio for over a decade, in fact, finding large marijuana grow operations all around Pike County.
Yeah, in 2010, the DEA had found over 23,000 plants in encampments where people lived in tents and grew the marijuana. So as the investigation progressed into these murders, investigators did find that the Roden family had connections to growing some pot. So maybe they had done something against the cartel, which could provide the motive and help find the people responsible. Now, the cartel was well known for being brutal and stealthy. The killers had gotten past watchdogs and security cameras, and they left behind no trace of themselves at the crime scenes. The killings were execution style and not crimes of passion.
Yes, it definitely seemed that way. And we're not sure if there was actually no trace, because, of course, none of this is public yet.
Right. But I would think that if the watchdogs didn't bark, that it probably was somebody that was known to them.
Exactly.
And not cartel members.
Yeah, and I don't know that they didn't bark necessarily, but they didn't attack, and they seemed to let whoever it was get by them.
Right. And they weren't killed. The dogs survived.
Right, right. That's another thing, is the cartel would probably kill the children and the dogs as well. Execution-style killings are usually done up close and at point-blank range, but some aspects of the killings are not what is usually seen in drug hits. Like, it's not normal for the cartel to kill so many family members in one location so far away from the Mexican border. The biggest problem with the drug-related killings theory is the fact that the kids were left unharmed. Leaving the children alive pointed to someone with some kind of morality, some small speck somewhere, right?
Right.
There had to be a little bit of empathy and compassion for these innocent children, but none whatsoever for adults or even for the 16-year-old, Chris Jr. The only ones left alive were the ones so young that they wouldn't be able to identify the killers. And the consensus from those who understood the cartel was that they would have killed everyone, including the babies, even the 4-day-old. So despite this evidence of a grow operation, the police set aside that cartel theory fairly early on.
Yeah, I'm not real impressed with it as a theory.
Okay.
So the people in Piketon were shocked and terrified after these killings, because they're worried. I mean, it could be a killer or killers amongst them. The up-close and personal nature of the killings led investigators to consider that the Rodens had been killed by someone they knew, someone who was angry with the Roden family and wanted to eliminate them. But investigators had no idea who was responsible or what the motive could have been.
But early on, they focused on the family's security system. The footage didn't show anything, so someone had to have turned it off or something. The rodents also had those attack dogs, and the attack dogs didn't attack. So that makes you think maybe the dogs were familiar with the killers, and especially Jake, who had actually lived there for quite a while, would know those dogs quite well.
Right, he would.
Dana Roden's sister, Bobby Jo Manley, was the first on the scene who discovered dead bodies, and then her brother James Manley was there. So we know that people who discover a crime scene are often the first suspects because sometimes a killer will call the police and pretend to have just innocently come upon a dead body. But after several interviews with James and Bobby Jo, law enforcement was not convinced that they had any reason to be there that morning. But Bobby Jo insisted they had nothing to do with those murders.
Judy and Leonard Manley, who were the parents of Dana, James, and Bobby Jo, were angry and frustrated that the police were looking at James and Bobby Jo. The idea that any of the family could be suspects just didn't go over well with them. And because Bobby Jo was the first one to find the bodies of Kenneth and Chris Sr., she was the focus of the police suspicions. She did finally agree to take a polygraph exam, and in fact she took several, and was finally eliminated as a suspect.
Yeah, and then her brother James Manley became the main focus of the investigation, especially once investigators learned that James had been texting with Jake Wagner at 2 a.m. on the night of the murders. Now, the context of the text is not known to the public, but James did fail a polygraph. He was released, but police suspected his involvement and decided to keep an eye on him. And what he didn't know is they also had those shoe prints that matched his shoes. So what the police did is they put a GPS tracker on James' truck and they followed him. But he found the tracker and removed it from his truck. And after doing that, they charged him with tampering with evidence and vandalism.
Oh, jeez.
Now, both of these charges were for removing the device from his own truck, which I just can't see how that's valid. But 6 days after that arrest, the charges were dismissed.
So I guess it wasn't valid.
I don't think it's something you'd go after someone for, but no. It was a way to get him in there and get him to talk more.
Sure.
But the police had found no evidence of James' involvement in the murders, and they also found no motive for him to be involved in it. It was possible there was only one killer, but the evidence was really pointing to more than one. These killings were definitely planned, premeditated, and they did show a certain level of sophistication. The Pike County Sheriff, Charles Reeder, told the media that he was convinced there had been more than one shooter.
Investigators took the property of the 8 victims as evidence, and this included their mobile homes, vehicles, and farm equipment. Now, these were stored in a warehouse that was an old chemical processing plant. Now, interesting sidelight here. After weeks of surveillance at the warehouse, a local news network ran a report about the inadequate security at the warehouse. According to the report, reporters had camped outside the warehouse for 3 weeks and saw no sign of any officers or security people. And in fact, the main gate to the warehouse was left open. Because of this, any evidence that would have been stored there probably wouldn't be admissible in court. There's just too many ways to contaminate it.
Well, yeah, these mobile homes were in the parking lot area, this big parking lot surrounding the warehouse. So all you'd have to do, even if the gate was locked, is jump it and you could plant something in one of the vehicles or the houses, or you could take things. So this was just terrible, terrible police work to do that.
Yeah, sure was.
So that didn't look good. And the Ohio Criminal Bureau of Investigation came in and put together a task force. And this included 100 officers to investigate these murders. The FBI helped as well, and the DEA did. But after a year, they were no further along in solving these murders at all. And the locals were just terrified that the case would never be solved and that they were living with killers among them. As the investigation dragged on, the townspeople became more reluctant to speak with police because they were afraid. They were afraid they might become the next victim, and their confidence in police was not very high. Faith in the police waned as time passed, and the killers remained free. Residents believed that if the murder of 8 people in their own homes couldn't be solved, their own lives were in danger, and the police wouldn't be able to help them.
Well, you'd sure think that way.
Yes.
No?
Certainly.
Leonard Manley told the police that the killers had to have been familiar with the Rodens, with their homes, and with their property. He felt that the killers had to know the family because the dogs had not attacked, and there were no signs of forced entry into the homes. Now, Leonard claimed that his daughter Dana had no part in the marijuana grow operation, and it was his feeling that her name was just being sullied with all the others, painted with the same brush, as they say.
Sure.
Now, just 6 days after the murders, Jake Wagner filed for custody of Sophia. This was a pretty odd and suspicious thing. It normally takes months to gather the documentation to file for custody. So this filing this early certainly suggested pre-planning and advanced knowledge that Hannah would be deceased. Around the same time, Angela Wagner told Jake that he should put together a GoFundMe page to help with the custody expenses. He did that, and he set his goal on the page of $20,000. His personal message on this page read, "These are not expenses I was supposed to have. I was supposed to be able to spend time with her and give her a happy childhood. Sophia and I are just asking for enough to settle the fees that we acquired due to the horrific tragedy to her mommy. I hate seeing my daughter cry. We want to get our lives back."
So, what do you think of that?
No.
No, even if he was innocent, you don't like it?
I don't like it. I don't like the GoFundMe stuff to begin with.
Yeah. But, I mean, there are some genuine cases. This one doesn't seem that genuine to me. The Wagner family was actually quite well off, owned a lot of land.
Yeah, so that wasn't an issue. It was more like a means of getting people to feel sorry for him.
Yeah, I kind of get that vibe as well, and then the cash wouldn't hurt either.
Right.
But a lot of people were offended by this GoFundMe campaign, especially people who believed that the Wagners were responsible for the murders. They complained about Jake having the gall to ask for money. But Jake was given custody of Sophia, and he did do his best to present himself as a sympathetic character. And there were some people who believed him, like close to half of the people in the town. They saw him as a single dad with these big legal bills and a new job that paid half of what he had been making. So he was living closer to Sophia, but he still had to make a daily commute to Cincinnati, which was a 2.5-hour daily drive.
Ugh.
So, poor Jake.
Well, I have some sympathy for him.
If he's innocent.
But, yeah, right. But I don't like the way he's going about it.
Well, there's probably a lot of things about Jake you wouldn't really like.
Probably not. Or there probably is. Now, at the one-year anniversary of the murders, the church held a vigil where hundreds of people showed up. Residents voiced their fears about the killings and worried that the case would never be solved. Now, the anniversary brought more attention from the media. And the media obviously pushed for more details from the police. Some information that had been kept confidential then became public when the autopsy results were released. Now, though the reports were heavily redacted, the number of shots used to kill the family members certainly showed overkill.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, according to the report, there was one victim with one gunshot wound, one victim with two gunshot wounds, two victims with three gunshot wounds, two with five, one with four, and then, of course, Chris Sr. had 9 gunshot wounds. So this does show some overkill.
Just a bit.
In May of 2017, the farm of local resident Bernard Brown was searched by the police. This was a longtime friend of the Wagner family. Jake had stored some cars and other things on the property. The investigators took a small utility trailer that was owned by the Wagners from his property. According to Brown, Jake Wagner had dropped some items off at his property about a week before the search was done. By early May, the Wagner family members had been interviewed several times by investigators, and Angela told a family member that the police just wouldn't leave her family alone.
And community members were accusing and harassing the Wagners when they were out in public in town. According to Angela, a woman had thrown a bottle at her and hit her in the back. And the community had turned against the Wagners, so Angela went on social media and claimed that her family was innocent.
Yeah, I'll read her post. Okay, I have decided to tell you all a couple of things about me and my family. What has happened to us in the past few weeks has been devastating, and it will follow us for the rest of our lives. Hannah was a daughter to me. I loved her dearly. Her loss still hurts to this day, especially when I see her every day in my granddaughter. We did not do anything to hurt Hannah's family. We want justice, just like everyone else. It is real disturbing. If you really want to know what you guys are doing, your accusations now will hurt Sophia later in life when she really understands what has happened. Let's try to find the real monsters who done this. So if Angela is really innocent, then it would have been really terrible for her to be shunned and accused by people in her town. I'm totally on board with that. But if she is guilty, the fact that she and her family were just going about their lives as they had before the murder shows hubris and a lot of coldness. Many people believe that Angela was the brains behind these murders as well. She had even been described as smug when filmed at some early court hearings. So shortly after her Facebook post, the Wagner family sold their farm, packed up some of their things, and moved to Alaska. They didn't hide their whereabouts from the authorities, but still a lot of people saw the move as an indicator of guilt. That October, investigators raided three of the Wagner's former properties to do a search. The task force had received hundreds of tips, but none of them had come to anything. So investigators were really hitting a dead end. With no evidence at the scenes and some differences in the killings at different locations, leads were very few and far between, and the case was really just going cold at this point.
Yeah, now when investigators searched the Wagner property, the townspeople speculated about whether the Wagners were involved in the murders. Unlike most Pike County families, the Wagners were pretty well off. The matriarch of the family was 76-year-old Frederica Wagner. She owned over 1,700 acres of land that was valued at over $4 million. She also owned a prosperous 300-acre horse farm named the Flying W. So Flying W Farm is an equestrian farm where they raise special horse breeds. Frederica and the Wagner family were also known as generous to their employees. She gave back to the community quite a bit. She was active in the church, and she owned rental properties.
Well, George Billy Wagner was well-liked in Piketon, and his wife Angela was known as a doting mother and grandmother. There were rumors that Billy and Chris Roden Sr. had some business dealings, but nothing was found that could have caused a mass murder. But two of their children did have this significant connection. Jake and Hannah had Sophia together. Hannah and Jake had never been married, but they had been in a serious relationship. Hannah had been the one to break things off with Jake, and she'd just given birth to this second girl that she named Kylie just days before she was killed. So remember, Hannah had not been sure who the father of her baby was, but a paternity test done after Hannah's death would show that Jake was not the biological father. The police and attorney general indicated that they were focused on the Wagner family, but they didn't come right out and name them as suspects at that point. But it was just after the one-year anniversary of the murders, when the Wagners had sold their property and moved to Alaska. And this was seen as a red flag. But according to the Wagners, they'd been planning this move for years. They had moved at that point to get away from the police who were harassing them. And they had not moved right after the murders, but they may have felt the focus of the investigation moving to them 1 year out and made this decision to get away. But then after 2 years, there were still no arrests.
Well, that's until November 2018. On that day, Billy Wagner, age 47, Angela, 48, Jake, 26, and Jake's brother George, age 27, were all arrested, charged with planning and carrying out the murders. So the residents of Piketon were divided in their opinions about their guilt or innocence. Pike County Sheriff spoke at a press conference, and he was convinced that the Wagners were responsible. Well, yeah, he just went and arrested them.
Yes,
what
exactly.
What are you going to say? We think we got the right people?
Yeah, well, we'll talk about him later. But a few days after those four arrests, two more Wagner family members were arrested. Billy Wagner's mother, Frederica Wagner, and Angela Wagner's mother, Rita Jo Newcomb, were arrested and charged with perjury and obstruction of justice for misleading investigators to cover up for the killers. So Angela's mother, Rita Newcomb, was charged with forging custody documents. Investigators now believed that the custody battle between Jake Wagner and Hannah Roden over their daughter Sophia provided the motive for the killings. Jake and Hannah were together when Sophia was born and they planned to be married, but when Hannah changed her mind and broke off the engagement, everybody agreed that Jake was very distraught. He'd tried everything to get back together, but Hannah was not interested. And when they broke up in 2015, Hannah was granted custody. Jake and his family, though, desperately wanted full custody of Sophia. Investigators believe that the Wagners killed 8 members of the Roden family so that no one in that family would be able to file for custody of Sophia. And that just seems drastic and crazy.
It really does.
But there's a lot of evidence that that was the motivation.
Yeah, there is. It seems almost beyond belief that they would go to this length or these lengths to have custody of this child.
Oh, it absolutely does. Yeah, it's crazy. But prosecutors claim that Rita Newcomb forged custody papers just weeks before the murders and tried to get Hannah to sign them. Then, just 6 days after the murders, Jake Wagner filed for custody, and he was granted custody in June of 2016. So you have to wonder, if Hannah had signed those papers and they had gotten Sophia, would those 8 people still be alive? I think probably. It's really interesting that Jake had picked up Sophia on the day of the murders, and that she wasn't in the home when her mother was shot to death. So if the Wagners are guilty, I definitely think that was part of the plan. They didn't want that girl to be there.
No. So the Wagner family was 4,000 miles away from Piketon in Kenai, Alaska, which is 187 miles south of Anchorage.
And this is before the arrests, yes.
Before they get arrested.
Yes.
They all lived in a double-wide trailer on a large property. Jake got a job in construction, and the family was making plans to buy a nice house. But the move had definitely raised some suspicions back in Ohio. Now, the first public sign that the Wagners were the prime suspects was when dozens of officers arrived at their former property to do an extensive search. Then an appeal was made to the public for any information about the Wagners.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty unusual.
To name specifically these people.
Yeah, and say we want information about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Wagner's attorney accused them at that point of harassing his clients.
Yeah, he told the Cincinnati Inquirer that the authorities were incompetent or they were involved in a cover-up. According to their attorney, John Clark, the Wagners were cooperating with the police. They had turned over laptops, phones, and DNA willingly.
Well, sure, but DNA is something they'd be able to get from them. It'd be easy to get a warrant to get their DNA.
Yeah.
And do we know if they turned over all their phones and laptops? We don't know. I think if it was this big of a planning operation, they probably had burner phones that they used to communicate with each other.
Well, you would think if they were going to go to this length.
Yeah. All the hacking and everything.
Yeah. They'd be more sophisticated.
I would think so. So I don't know that cooperation was so impressive or extensive. But Jake Wagner told a Cincinnati Inquirer reporter that he had moved to give his daughter Sophia a better life in Alaska. He said they weren't in hiding and the police knew where they were living. And that's true, the police did know they were there. But in Alaska, the Wagners became parishioners of the local church in Kenai and seemed to be making an effort to fit into this new community. Their pastor even described them as good country people. At the church, Jake was introduced to a young woman named Elizabeth Armour, another church member, and they dated for several months and then they got married in March of 2018. But eventually, Elizabeth Armour would be on Facebook warning people about how dangerous it was to be involved with the Wagners. In one post, she wrote that God had told her to come forward about her relationship with Jake. She said that she was introduced to and encouraged by the pastor to get to know Jake, but she claimed that she had had no idea at the time that the Wagners were involved in this murder investigation back in Piketon. Also, she wrote that when the topic of the Roden family massacre came up, the pastor actually vouched for the Wagners and said that the charges were just slander against the family. And I don't know who the hell he thinks he was doing that. What did he know about it?
Yeah, I'm just thinking they hadn't lived there that long.
No.
For this pastor to arrive at this conclusion.
So you wonder if it's just that they were tithing, and that's what he liked.
Possibly.
But Elizabeth wrote that she had just wanted to be a mother to Sophia, but found out she'd married her worst nightmare. All of her posts have been taken down now, and Elizabeth hasn't made any public statements since then.
Rats.
So she's just kind of out of the picture.
She's been silenced.
Yes. Well.
But she's still up and breathing.
She's alive as far as we know, sure.
2 years after the Roden murders, the Wagners returned to the Piketon area. According to a family member, the Wagners had returned because Billy Wagner's father got sick and because they couldn't afford to live there anymore. The plan was to get things situated financially and eventually return to Alaska to live. The return of the family was a surprise. The Wagners tried to return to normal lives, but they just weren't welcomed in Piketon. Well, they weren't welcomed before they left. According to Angela, after a few weeks, people in the community resumed their harassment. Their cars were vandalized, and they were just not welcomed in local establishments.
Well, yeah, I think since the sheriff had gone public saying he wanted to know more about them and everything, that they were even liked less than they had been before.
Yeah, because now they've got some ammunition that the Wagners are bad people.
Right. So, a raid was done on another Wagner family property, and this was a farm that used to be owned by Jake and George. Investigators found a homemade silencer, at the bottom of a well on the property. And on November 13, 2018, Angela and Billy Wagner, along with their sons Jake and George, were arrested for the murders of the 8 Roden family members. Angela's mother, Rita, and Billy's mother, Frederica, were also arrested in conjunction with the cover-up. They were each arrested for obstruction of justice and perjury. And Rita Jo was also charged with forgery. But all 6 of these people pled not guilty.
Now, these 2 grandmothers might seem like unlikely criminals, but a look into the past of Frederica Wagner revealed some earlier red flags. She was the matriarch of the family, and she was the owner of properties throughout Pike County. She had also founded 2 nonprofit organizations. The first was Lucasville Mission, which is a church that helps underprivileged children. And the other is the Crystal Springs Home. This is an organization that helps developmentally disabled adults. She was well known in the community. Some people loved her, others feared her. Well, right now, it sounds like she's a very altruistic woman.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of good things to say about her. And she looks like just the small-town grandmother in so many ways.
Okay, so let's get some dirt on her.
Well, her attorney described her as a God-fearing woman who taught Sunday school, but she had some business dealings which painted a different picture of her. So this farm, the Flying W, breeds horses, dogs, and pigs. And in the 1990s, Frederica had some legal troubles with some customers over the sale of some pigs. A group of customers sued her over her farm not meeting standards and for fraudulently selling them pigs who didn't match the description advertised by her. There were rumors over the years which caused many of the locals to fear her, too. They had made money selling horses and miniature horses, and there were some indications that the horses had been stuffed with drugs and moved back and forth to Mexico to transport illegal drugs. But these are all rumors. I only bring them up because I want to get a feel for the community and what people are thinking. Frederica was also well known for her rent-to-own program, developed to help lower-income residents achieve home ownership. Over the years, Frederica entered into at least 130 land installment contracts. So these contracts allowed the Wagners to hold the deeds on land as buyers paid off the principal and the interest. If the buyers made all of their payments, they were assured that they would eventually be owners of the property. But only 12 of the 130 contracts were ever satisfied. And looking back at the deals, 80% of them were ultimately terminated without a deed being transferred. So despite the renters making all of their payments, the vast majority of the properties remained in Frederica's possession. Many of these people felt tricked by her and taken advantage of. There was one tenant who described his rental as a real trash pit, too. It was a one room with the toilet exposed in one corner. So was Frederica more of a slumlord than someone helping the poor? Kind of sounds like it.
It certainly does.
These land contracts had many holes in them that she used to her own benefit. And I did just a little background reading on this, and these rent-to-own things, pretty common scams against poor people.
They're a scam, right.
If you're going to scam someone, scam some rich bastard. Why would you scam poor people who just want to own their house?
Frederica Wagner had not approved of Angela when she married her son Billy. Angela has been described by some Piketon residents as a shady person. She had a past. Now, in 2001, Angela and Billy were charged with improper handling of a firearm. In 2012, they were both charged with a felony for receiving stolen property. The 2001 firearm charge was an alleged road rage incident where Angela pulled out a gun, but no one was shot. So that makes it okay, right?
Well, it makes it better than if you shot someone, that's for sure.
This occurred 15 years prior to the murders, so maybe these charges don't seem real significant. But with Frederica, we see some poor character and dishonesty. Still, nothing that would predict a mass murder plot.
That's the problem. On June 26, 2019, Frederica had her pretrial hearing. The charges against her were dismissed. Prosecutors had accused her of lying to a grand jury about two bulletproof vests that were found in Billy's bedroom on her family farm when investigators searched there back in 2017. According to one family member not charged, Frederica had not purchased the vest prior to the murders, but actually 2 weeks after the murders. According to prosecutors, Frederica had misrepresented where she had purchased these vests. Overall, the charges against her just seemed like they were mainly brought forward in an effort to get her to talk about the murders and maybe turn on some of her family members. But that didn't happen. So it was dropped, but the prosecutor reserved the right to charge her again in the future. But when the charges were dismissed, Frederica was happy. She stood up, she waved to her supporters, thanked her attorneys, and said, "Praise Jesus." She was quoted as saying, "Trust in the Lord with all you can, and he will lead you down the righteous path." And then she added, "They have no evidence."
She had me up until there.
So that's the end of that.
Rita Newcomb agreed to a plea deal. She took a reduced misdemeanor charge of obstructing official business. The felony charges of forgery, perjury, and obstructing justice were dismissed. Angela, Billy, Jake, and George Wagner all remain in jail on murder charges, and they could face the death penalty.
So one interesting piece of evidence are Excel spreadsheets that have hundreds of entries with messages, including screenshots about child custody. This could point to the motive by showing that the Wagners were obsessed with getting custody of Sophia. Prosecutors on the case have also talked about a confidential informant who told them about a meeting at Frederica's house with the other accused family members. According to this informant, the family discussed taking revenge on Attorney General Mike DeWine and on Pike County Sheriff Charles Reeder. So we don't know who the informant was, but to me, it seems unlikely that the Wagners are going to discuss this stuff, you know, killing the AG and the sheriff in front of some outsider.
That's a stretch.
So if that's true, maybe the informant is a Wagner family member who's turning on the others. I mean, otherwise, I can't see it. At the pretrial hearing for George Wagner to get released from prison on bond, the prosecution presented some of the evidence they had against him because they wanted to keep him locked up. One of the lead detectives testified that the police have ballistic evidence connecting firearms used in the murders to guns believed to have been owned by the Wagners. So this includes a .40 caliber handgun, a .22 rifle, and a .30 caliber gun. They also have the shoe prints that match the shoes purchased at Walmart by the Wagners in their alleged effort to frame James Manley. The prints were found in dried blood at two different crime scenes. They also found the receipts for the shoes on the Wagners' property. So that's pretty good evidence.
That is.
They also had thousands of recorded statements from interviews with George Wagner, where he claimed that there were no custody issues between Jake and Hannah over Sophia at all. But we have plenty of evidence that shows that's not the case.
And something else was brought up at George Wagner's recent pretrial hearing. This is a screenshot of a message from Hannah Roden to a friend of hers. In the message, Hannah is telling the friend about the Wagner's attempts to force her to sign forged custody documents. The screenshot was found on the Wagner home computer, and they had accessed it by hacking into Hannah's Facebook account. The message reads, "I won't sign papers ever. It won't happen. They'll have to kill me first."
That's a bit haunting.
It is.
You know, there really is a lot of evidence that the Wagner family was obsessed with getting custody of that girl. People who knew the family have said that custody had been an issue for the Wagners before. So George Wagner and his ex-wife were married for several years. That's Jake's big brother. And they had a son together. According to her, the family tried to force her to sign over custody of her son. Angela had manipulated the ex-wife and hired attorneys, eventually taking custody of the boy. The Wagners then maintained custody all the way up to the time of their arrests. So the family definitely kept the boy's mother away from him as much as possible. It does show an earlier pattern.
Hannah had contacted George's ex-wife for advice when the family came after Sophia, and the ex-wife told her not to listen to them or sign anything without her own attorney. Now, of course, we still have the evidence that the Wagners did actually try to trick Hannah into signing over custody of Sophia to them.
Yes. There are many indications that the Wagners are very manipulative people. Angela Wagner, in fact, did try to influence testimony from prison. She called her mom, Rita Jo Newcomb, several times and asked her not to testify against the family. She also gave her advice on how to explain the forged documents. As punishment, a judge took away Angela's phone and mail privileges. And this behavior, of course, is very bad for her defense. Any conversations from prison can be used against her at trial.
So what about the idea that the Pike Sheriff's Department is incompetent? The Roden murders made the news nationally, but there had been other sort of similar murders in Piketon, Ohio. Now, you might think this, nothing ever happens in this place, right?
Right, yep.
But you found a lot of stuff.
Yes. So there had been at least 3 recent cases in Pike County with multiple homicides. One is the case of 48-year-old Candace Newsom and her 16-year-old daughter, Christina, who went by the name Michael. This was in January of 2016, so that's just 3 months before the Rodens were killed. So the 2 victims were shot execution style. It took 3 years, but a neighbor man was arrested for the murders just last year. There has been speculation that there was an accomplice, but that hasn't been brought up. Candace's sister, Darla, has spoken out expressing her opinion that her sister and niece's murders may be related to the Roden murders. And she said that they did run in the same circles, so some of them knew each other.
Then in April 2016, just weeks before the Roden murders, young couple Douglas Eatman and Carolyn Ann Tomlinson were executed in their home. This was a double homicide in the middle of the night with 4 children left alive, though eerily similar to the Roden murders. Charles Elmer Eatman and James Allen Eatman were indicted for murder and tampering with evidence. These are Douglas's cousin and uncle, and at least part of the motive is believed to have revolved around the family drug-dealing business.
The motive for Candace and her daughter's murders isn't known, but many locals have been critical of it taking over 3 years for them to arrest the next-door neighbor in the case. And I could see that.
Yes.
In the 3rd other case in Pike County is the December 2006 case of the murders of engaged couple, 34-year-old Kurt Francis and 30-year-old Jennifer Burgett. And this one is still unsolved. There have been no arrests or really any persons of interest mentioned. They were both shot and killed in their beds in the middle of the night. Kurt and Jennifer lived just about 10 miles away from the Roden's property, but their case has not gotten anywhere near the amount of publicity. There is a belief by those living in the area that Jennifer and Kurt were just nice people who got involved with some local drug dealers, the wrong people. Much of the crime in the area, though, is drug-related. They have a big opioid and meth problem there. And there were drug dealers living right down the street from Kurt and Jennifer. and apparently Kurt owed them some money. So according to the authorities, on the day of the murder, Kurt had been drinking with these drug people when he and Jennifer had an argument. And during the argument, Jennifer said that she was going to stay at her mother's house overnight. So the couple's families think that the people who Kurt had been drinking with overheard their conversation and decided they would go rob Kurt, believing that Jennifer wouldn't be home. But after they had broken into the house, they saw Jennifer and decided they had to kill them both. So I'm not sure why the family thinks this, but the family also thinks they have an idea of who did it. They know who these people are.
Yeah.
But no arrests, nothing.
Investigators believe that the shooter is responsible for at least one other murder. Several leads have been investigated, but not enough information was obtained to justify any arrests. The family suspected to be connected to the murder was investigated, and police found a well on their property that was covered up by garbage and rocks.
Yeah, so this story is just amazing in a horrible way. Shows the incompetence, I guess.
Yeah,
and that's why we brought it in.
Just making your head shake.
Yeah, so investigators, they know that there's a couple of guns down a well. So they move a camera down there on a pole or whatever, and they saw the two guns 30 feet down, and one of which was believed to be the gun that was used in the murders. So there was also some burned clothing down there that was probably some pretty good evidence. But police made this horrible decision to retrieve the evidence by pumping water into the well from a fire hose. And this didn't go as they had planned at all. This is embarrassing for them. The force of the water caused the ground to break up, and the guns actually went further into the earth. So, turns out, I guess this evidence is lost and irretrievable.
Yeah, I don't know why.
They said it's too expensive to get it.
Oh, okay.
But
sure.
Do you do that in a murder investigation? Not
no.
usually. But what they did, anyway, is they apparently closed up the well with a steel plate, had someone come in and do that. But family of the victims were quite outraged and upset and said, this is just complete incompetence to do this. How will it ever be solved?
It might not be.
So you can kind of see now why the community didn't have a lot of confidence in the Pike County Sheriff's Office.
Well, yeah, but the Pike County Sheriff's Office also had state police and FBI helping them. So they got a bunch of incompetence.
True enough. Yeah, I guess so. Well, the Pike County Sheriff, Charlie Reeder, had key pieces of evidence from the Roden case moved to that warehouse, which was in the nearby town of Waverly. That was about a month after the murders. Now, this included the mobile homes and other vehicles in that huge lot with the fence around it. But we know that it was unsecured. So there was no police guard. There was nothing keeping the public from this important evidence. The chain of custody was broken, which can, of course, have a really bad effect on the case, could damage it.
Yes.
So that's when local Cincinnati news reporter Jody Barr had contacted the Pike County Sheriff, Charlie Reeder, with his concerns and told him that he planned to air a report on the TV news about the warehouse area being unsecured. And according to Jody, he was approached after that by Sheriff Reeder trying to make a deal for them not to run the story. Reeder offered access to the news crew to do an exclusive on the first 100 hours with the sheriff in the Roden murder investigation if they would agree not to run the story about the lack of security where the evidence was stored. And they were pretty outraged by this. This is not a cool thing to do.
No.
So they told the sheriff, we don't make deals, and they went ahead with that story. But this Sheriff Reeder was really at the center of the Roden investigation. His deputies and state agents spent 2 years tracking the suspects before they made the arrests, but he was suspended in the spring of this year. Prosecutors have alleged that Reeder misappropriated about $15,000 in seized funds and also borrowed $6,000 from his employees. He was also accused of circumventing the rules at his department's auctions to get impounded vehicles for his family members. So he has faced 16 charges, and a grand jury has indicted him on 2 additional charges, including a felony charge of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity, which carries a recommended prison sentence of 2 to 8 years. He pleaded guilty at the end of September to 5 charges, including tampering with records, theft in an office, and conflict of interest. Some criminal justice experts have said that Reeder's conviction could really be a problem for prosecuting this case.
I would think so.
Yes. But Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost told Fox 19 Now, the local news network, that Reeder's indictment would have no impact on the Wagner capital murder case, as Sheriff Reeder was not the primary witness for any issue of fact or law. But I don't believe that.
Well, if you're trying to paint the investigation as incompetent and corrupt, you've got a good poster boy for it.
Right, exactly. So, yeah.
We'll see.
So the three children who were spared during the killings, Kylie, Hannah's newborn, lives with her father, Charlie Gilley. Brentley, the three-year-old, lives with his mother. And Ruger, Frankie and Hannah Hazel, Gilley's six-month-old infant, is living with family members. Sophia, the one who's at the center of this whole thing, Jake and Hannah's daughter, is currently in the custody of Child Protective Services. But I have read a few things about her going to family members on the Roden side, which there are people in the family who think they can give her a good home, and you think they'd go with family before strangers. Although in this case, it's very complicated.
And so it looks like right now the police are waiting for one of the four Wagners, Angela, Billy, George, or Jake, to try to talk or make a deal. The Wagners have been incarcerated and apart for years now. So I really wonder if one of them is the informant that was mentioned earlier. Jake had reasons to be hurt and angry and plot the murders. I think Angela, too, would see reasons to follow through with the plan. She wanted custody of Sophia very badly, and had already managed to get custody of another grandchild, George's son. I can see Billy being really motivated in the murder, too, since he allegedly had a falling out with Chris Roden Sr. But what about Jake's big brother, George?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he was just a follower, but it just seems like this was a close-knit family. Family was a big deal, like it is with everyone, of course, but sometimes more with country people. But, you know, it's been, what, now 4 years since they've been arrested? So it wouldn't surprise me if maybe George talks. Maybe he's the informant, even. So they have been apart for 2 years since they've been arrested. Over 2 years, so maybe he's the informant. We'll find out eventually. It's interesting to watch. The Wagners have waived their right to a speedy trial, and now the trials are postponed. Remember, all four have pleaded not guilty and have been held at separate jails in Ohio, and they do face the death penalty. At a hearing for George earlier this year, a special agent with the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation testified that there were three murder weapons and one of the guns, a Walther Colt 1911-22 pistol, was the type Wagner owned at one time. So this Walther Colt pistol has not been found.
Interesting.
Yes. And the prosecutor has said he wants Jake to go to trial first before his brother and his parents. So that makes me curious of what's going on there. The trials were supposed to begin this past fall, but there have been postponements related to the COVID pandemic. So hopefully one day we will know what happened, but I don't think we'll ever know the full story.
Doesn't sound like it. There's too much going on here.
Yes. Very complex case.
Mm-hmm.
Authorities estimate that investigators have conducted tens of thousands of hours of investigative work on this case. They followed more than 1,100 tips from the public. They've conducted over 500 interviews, tested more than 700 items of evidence, and they've served more than 200 subpoenas, search warrants, and court orders as well. So this has been a big job for them.
Very busy.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm leaning towards their guilt here, but there's just a lot of funny things I don't understand. You know, funny, odd things.
I know.
There's so much to it. And, you know, we're working with only part of the information. The police have to keep some things from the public. So it'll be really fascinating to see what happens when these trials begin.
Yeah.
I'd like to see if one of them is going to turn state's witness or whatever you call it. So our sources for this case include the Pike County Coroner's Office press release from April 26, 2016, articles from ABC News Online from April of 2019, the Associated Press articles from November of 2020, an article from the Columbus Dispatch from April 22, 2020. There is a podcast by iHeartRadio titled The Piketon Murders, which I found really fascinating. They do repeat a lot of the same stuff. But other than that, there was a lot of good information there. We also looked at the Fox 19 Now WXIX-TV news reports by Jody Barr from October and November of 2016 and from November of 2018. Oxygen.com has a documentary titled The Piketon Family Murders. It's about an hour and a half long, and that has a lot of information in it as well. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. And just a quick reminder, we do have merch on sale on our website, tiegrabber.com. And if you'd like to get your future TCB episodes commercial-free, get an extra members-only episode each month, and get a free beer glass, bottle opener, or a set of coasters, along with stickers, magnets, and buttons, you might want to consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber at tiegrabber.com. Now, I rarely mention this, but we also do have all of our episodes and bonus episodes available on our Patreon page for those who prefer using that venue to offer support to us. Our patrons get bonus episodes and a gift as well. So enough self-serving shit. Let's do the feedback. All voicemails today, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like feast or famine around here. So today we're going to feast. We've got three voicemails.
All right, I'm going to start out with Karen, who was just commenting on a documentary that we watched as well.
Hello there, Jill and Dick. I hope that you're keeping very well and very safe, and that all of you and your pets are doing really well, continuing to absolutely love your podcasts. I just wanted to drop you a quick line. This is Karen from Toronto, Canada, one of your longtime listeners and admirers. And I just wanted to let you know that there's an excellent four-part documentary series on HBO. Perhaps you've seen it. It's called Murder on Middle Beach. And it's just remarkable. It's so remarkably well done. And I just thought I'd pass it along in case you haven't heard about it. So wishing you all the best, and thank you so much for all that you do. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Karen. You are so kind. We really appreciate it. Murder on Middle Beach. Yes, we did watch it. It's right up our alley. We were hoping there'd be more episodes because it was one of those things where you didn't get an ending.
Not yet.
No.
I was impressed with the kid. I guess he's not a kid. He's an adult now. But
yeah, it's a son in his 20s talking about the murder of his mother.
Right.
Yeah.
And he did a very, very good job.
Yes,
he's going to,
he might make a career out of this documentary making stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is a very fascinating story, and we'd recommend it to people as well. You know, if there's ever a resolution, I'd love to cover it on our show as well.
Oh, we would.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks so much again, Karen. And now we have a case suggestion from TJ.
Greetings, Jill and Dick. I just had a quick suggestion of a case you could possibly look into. I've been a lifelong country music fan, and one of the most famous murders that surrounds country music is the murder of Grand Ole Opry star Dave Aikman, who was professionally known as String Bean, and his wife Estelle. There has been several good articles written on it, and at least one hour-long TV documentary that has made its way to YouTube, but I would love to hear your all's take on it. I love all your work, and I appreciate everything you do. Gives us a lot to do during this time, a lot to listen to, and keep it up. Thanks.
Well, thanks a lot, TJ. I'm thinking Karen and TJ, if they did a podcast together, they've just got lovely voices, don't they?
Don't they?
Yeah, melodic, really.
Well, this guy, Aikman, known as String Bean, I think that's because he was 6'5" tall and kind of skinny.
Yeah.
He was a regular on Hee Haw and the Grand Ole Opry, as TJ said. He was famous for wearing not outlandish clothing, but his preferred clothing was a shirt, a pair of shorts with a belt buckle around his knees, so it looked like his waist was at his knees.
Well, a lot of those Grand Ole Opry and Hee Haw people, they all had their own little
This was
personality, their own little setup, like the one with the tags on our hats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he and his wife were murdered by some burglars in 1973. There were two cousins that were convicted of the murders. One of them died in prison. The other was paroled about 6 years ago. And I hadn't found anything that details his life after parole. So hopefully he's been clean.
Yeah, I wasn't able to find anything after parole, but I did find the article from 2014 when he was released. He was 64 when he was released.
Yeah, he served 41 years.
Yeah, a long time.
Yep.
So it was on the evening of November 11th, 1973, when John Brown and his cousin, Doug Brown, ransacked the Aikmans' cabin on their farm near Nashville. So I guess they were looking for some cash that they thought Aikman was keeping there. Police said the cousins were surprised when the Aikmans came home, and John shot String Bean as he walked into the cabin and then ran after the wife in the yard and shot her in the back of the head. I have to wonder, were these guys drunk? Something was really strange about this, or desperate.
Yeah.
So their bodies weren't found until the next day. They were found by fellow Opry performer Grandpa Jones, who was a close friend who lived nearby. Although police said the motive for the slayings was robbery, the Browns only took a chainsaw and some guns. And it wasn't until 1996 when the police found the cash that they were looking for, and actually String Bean had concealed it in the walls of his home. So another senseless two murders.
Yep.
But yeah, fascinating case. I'd like to find out more about it. So definitely a good case suggestion. All right. So one more voicemail, and this one is from Patrick with two case suggestions.
He's got two.
Hello, Dick and Jill. This is Patrick from Ireland, and I'm ringing to recommend two cases from this part of the world. The first case is the case of Alan Haw, H-A-W-E, who murdered his family and then killed himself a few years back in Ireland. And it's a very, very tragic case, and it's worth checking out. The second case is the murder of Bobby Ryan in Tipperary in Ireland. And that's a very interesting case about relationships and love. And a man was sentenced about 2 years ago for that crime. That's worth checking out. In terms of beers, I would be errant to not recommend something from the Guinness Brewery, not your normal Guinness draft that everybody's used to, but some variations that they've gone into in the last couple of years. First recommendation is Guinness West Indies Stout, and the second recommendation is Guinness Milk Stout. There are two variants that the brewery has gone into in order to try and compete with the craft beer market, and they're pretty good. Okay, Dick and Jill, thanks for everything. Bye.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, those are two good cases.
You know, what about the beer? Are those beers available over here, do we know?
I don't think I've seen the milk stout, but the West Indies stout I've had.
Yes.
It was part of a mixed pack. Guinness has also just made some barrel-aged stouts that I'd love to try if my package store would ever get them.
Ah, all right. Okay, so yeah, these two cases. The first one is actually murder-suicide. It's very tragic. Now, 2016 and about to be exposed as a cross-dresser addicted to porn, is that really that shameful nowadays? When I first heard about this, I thought, oh, it must have been back in the 60s or something.
No, and there was some suggestion of some inappropriate sexual behavior at the school he taught.
Oh, well, there's another
so that
whole
might
other
be
level.
Something else.
Okay.
But yeah, he had his three kids were ages 6 to 13, something like that, and his wife.
So why kill all of them? That's what I don't understand.
And then himself.
Right. But if you're that depressed and you're going to take your life, that's a tragedy, of course. But then why would you kill other people too, especially children? It's just, well, it's tragic all around, for sure. And then Bobby Ryan, a love triangle. What do we know about that?
Not much.
Okay.
Nope.
So we'll look that up.
Yes, we will. Patrick Quirk was the gentleman convicted of Bobby Ryan's murder.
That's not our Patrick who left the voicemail. That's a different Patrick, I hope.
I would hope so. I'm confessing to my own murder.
No, I imagine Patrick is a fairly common name, especially in Ireland.
I would think.
Yeah, but another lovely voice. So thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. Thanks for the suggestions.
Yes, and just thank you to everyone for taking time out of your day to listen to us or just to let us entertain you while you're doing some kind of work around the house or whatever. We definitely appreciate it. And, of course, we appreciate your feedback. Keep that coming.
We love feedback.
Yeah.
Thanks for the voicemails. Gives me something to do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And we'll see everybody next time at the Quiet End.
Saving a seat for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.